It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Ellen Carol Du Bois is UCLA Distinguished Research Professor of History. Her book is Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote. And this far from the first book she's written about suffrage in the United States. She's gone back and written books that have been used as textbooks on the subject. She is a foremost historian on the topic of women earning the right to vote in the United States. Professor, it's good to have you with us again on Air Talk.
Always wonderful to see you, Larry, and hear you, Larry.
Well, here we've got the centennial of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, women with the right to vote, and I assume that's what spurred this volume. But you also have some figures that are perhaps lesser known in the suffrage movement. And for you, who's been spending decades in this work, were there even some new things you found in your research here?
Well, I was just rereading the last few chapters before I came in, and it reminded me of one of the people that I really like a lot, who I learned a lot about. Her name was Maud Wood Park. She was a Boston woman. She'd gone to Radcliffe. When she was there in the 1890s, she was one of only two students who supported woman suffrage. But she committed herself to this work. Her private life was challenging and difficult. She had a really difficult husband. And then she was asked to take on the work of lobbying Congress. She was asked by the intimidating head of the suffrage movement, Carrie Chapman Catt. She doubted she had the capacity, and she thought she was more of a demonstrator and a protester, but she did the work. And she organized a lobbying army of hundreds of women who went into Congress for several years until they convinced first the House and then the Senate to pass the Woman Suffrage Amendment in the midst of the First World War and the flu epidemic. And I was just really impressed with the sort of quiet courage of these lobbyists who learned how to do something that women weren't supposed to do. They called themselves the front door lobby.
And so these are the people trying to work the inside.
Yes.
Not necessarily having the well-attended rallies, barnstorming the country and giving the bell-ringing speeches.
And not picketing the White House and getting arrested, as another wing of the suffrage movement was doing. But they had information on each member of Congress, including their woman relatives and whether any of them were for suffrage and their other political positions. And they also had a list of rules. Don't nag. Knock on the door before you enter. You never know what's going on inside the office. Be friends with the secretary and never do anything to close the door to the next opponent.
That's probably good advice for lobbyists in 2020.
Absolutely.
Too. Professor, let's go back to the earliest meetings devoted to women's suffrage, 1848, and Seneca Falls, New York. What happens there that's so important in galvanizing the movement?
Well, let's also remember something about the year. 1848 was one of those years of historic importance internationally. There were revolutions across Europe for expanded democracy. That was the year that Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto. It was the year when the United States was at war in Mexico and gained a quarter of its land mass. And it was also the year when the anti-slavery movement moved into electoral politics itself, with a series of parties, the culmination of which was the Republican Party. And this really made women who had been part of the anti-slavery coalition and had always emphasized their moral power to begin to see that they needed to work politically as well. They had begun to learn, as Elizabeth Cady Stanton said, about women's rights in the anti-slavery school, basically as a form of human rights, of individual rights. And what happened at Seneca Falls was that a really compelling list of grievances and resolutions, which remain very moving today. If you read the grievances of the Declaration of Independence, they're like, they don't have any meaning. They're about, harboring soldiers in your house. But the grievances and the resolutions in the Declaration of Sentiments are still extremely powerful. The final one, and the only one that was really controversial, was that women had to fight for the right to vote. And that ultimately passed the convention. Elizabeth Stanton credited the one man there who didn't have the right to vote, and that was Frederick Douglass, that his support had made the difference in bringing that vote to a positive resolution.
Before slavery is abolished, are the women's movement for the right to vote closely aligned with the abolition movement?
Yes. Before 1848 and afterwards and through the Civil War, campaign for women's rights and the leaders of it are basically a subset of the abolitionist movement. One of the things I knew, but I hadn't really focused on, was that in the midst of the war, these women's rights activists, Stanton, Anthony, and Lucy Stone, organize the first popular movement in favor of a constitutional amendment, and that's the amendment to abolish slavery. They collected more than 100,000 signatures on petitions. And we could say arguably – no, I'll leave out arguably. We could say that the 13th Amendment was pushed forward through Congress and then through ratification by a movement organized by and populated by women.
We're talking with UCLA Distinguished Professor of History Ellen Carroll Du Bois. Her book, Suffrage: Women's Long Battle for the Vote. What happens then after the Civil War and free black men have the right to vote? What happens then between these two movements?
Well, when the third of these amendments, the 15th Amendment, is going through Congress, women suffragists expected that they would be included in the press for the vote. They expected that the language of the 15th Amendment would include a prohibition against disfranchisement by sex as well as by race, color, and previous condition of servitude. And when that didn't happen, and that didn't happen because Republicans couldn't count on the votes of women in the way that they could count on the votes of black men in the South, one wing of the suffragist movement became, one can only say, enraged. As Elizabeth Stanton said, again, I quote her, "The constitutional door was going to slam shut." She was right. There wasn't another constitutional amendment till the 20th century. And they pressed hard to get women included. Then they argued against the 15th Amendment. And Stanton, among others, but especially Stanton, did so out of her rage with rhetoric, anti-black rhetoric, and also anti-immigrant rhetoric, which is hard to read even today, and it was then too. She talked about Sambo getting the right to vote, as well as Young Tung and Hans and Patrick. Her anger was at all these men who she thought shouldn't be coming ahead of, as she said, women like herself, the daughters of the founding fathers. That the association of one wing of the suffrage movement with campaigns against black rights split the two issues apart. At that point, as we move into the late 70s and early 80s, we're moving into a period in which black rights no longer has any kind of political support, any kind of support politically in the Supreme Court. And at that point, the women's suffrage movement becomes of a piece with the growing Jim Crow and anti-black vote sentiment of the late 19th century.
We'll continue our conversation with UCLA professor Ellen Carroll DuBois. Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote, published in this centennial year of women through the 19th Amendment having the right to vote. We're talking about the earliest origins of the movement, who some of the leaders were, going back to the middle of the 19th century, and then, of course, into the early 20th century, where so much is going on in the world. The Spanish flu that was just mentioned, of course, and looming World War I, all these very important factors going in as women seek the right to vote. We'll continue our conversation in just a minute. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. On August 26th, 100 years ago, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified. I'm here with Ellen Carroll DuBois, Distinguished Professor of History at UCLA. Her book is Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote. We were just talking about how there was an alignment between the abolition movement and the suffrage movement before the Civil War. Then after the Emancipation Proclamation, African-American men get the right to vote. So we have this schism that takes place. What, though, were African-American women who were fighting for suffrage doing?
I'm glad you asked that. Well, from the beginning, there are always a handful of black women who are part of the women's rights and women's suffrage movement. Most famously, the great and towering figure of Sojourner Truth, who has now been memorialized in a statue, who will be memorialized in a statue along with Stanton and Anthony in Central Park. But after the Civil War and after the emancipation of slavery, in the succeeding decades, black people in the United States and black women in particular move exceedingly quickly forward in education and public engagement, despite the fact that the forces arrayed against them are also growing. The figure that returns us to this story is a woman named Ida B. Wells, after she married Ida B. Wells Barnett, one of the first women in the United States to hyphenate her name upon marriage. She was a Tennessee woman. She developed a campaign in the late 1880s and early 1890s against the scourge of lynching. And for that, she was really burnt out of her newspaper offices and fled to Chicago. From there, she engaged in a campaign both in England and the United States against lynching, and always or regularly commented on the fact that laws against lynching required the franchise among both black men and black women. In the wake of her efforts, black women's clubs were organized and federations. At this point, black women were not really welcomed in most of the white-dominated suffrage organizations. So they fought from within their own organizations, where they had, because of the experience of their race with the 15th Amendment and its erosion in the late 19th century, they recognized that gaining votes for black women would have a tremendous impact on the race. So from then on, especially in places where the black vote is still accepted, northern cities like Chicago and New York, where there's a Republican Party organization, black women are important. From 1912 on, because the country is under the control of Democrats, who are under the control of Southern white supremacists, black women are really shut out of all activism at the national level.
What's going on in the churches at this point? African-American churches, more liberal U.S. denominations. What is it? Are any of them taking up the cause of suffrage?
Well, churches for black women are a central organizational locale for their works, and also where they have fought for kind of right to vote within their churches to help determine their churches. I don't think that religious institutions are as important for white women, although the first important organization, mass women's organization, to undertake support for the vote was the Woman's Christian Temperance Union. Now, that's not a religious organization per se, but clearly it has a religious connection as indicated in the title of the organization. And its president, the great and now unfortunately forgotten Francis Willard, brought this organization, which was made up of pious Midwestern and Western small town women, into the suffrage movement. The WCTU, just to connect with what I was saying before, was really it encouraged and brought in Black women who gained a lot of organizational experience in the WCTU.
They were integrated.
They weren't integrated. They were in segregated unions, but they were accepted into the organization and recognized and appreciated at the national level.
When I think of the WCTU, you know, so often we think of them as bringing us prohibition, and that they were, you know, from the movie versions, a bunch
the
of, you know,
wielding,
exactly.
But, yeah.
That's the image. What I think, and I'd love to have you elaborate on this, was that what really drove this? Yes, there was a moral crusade against alcohol, but what they saw as abuse in the home, terrible treatment of women and of children, the kinds of things that alcohol exacerbated.
Yes. The WCTU started, and back to your question about religious impact, they started by praying outside of saloons, and they had an immediate effect. They sort of, you know, no guy wants to walk through a group of praying women in order to escape his wife and get a good beer. But that didn't last very long. It burned out. And it's at that point that Willard really argues for the voting as a tool against a scourge, which doesn't take much to convince women, is a woman's crusade. Men's drinking uses up limited family resources and is connected with violence against women and children. Willard brilliantly, what we would say, rebranded suffrage. The term woman's suffrage made women uncomfortable. It's sort of like, you know, the movement to legalize abortion branding itself pro-choice.
Yeah.
So she called the woman's suffrage goal, she called it the home protection ballot. So here was the point. You were to get the right to vote. You were, of course, a woman and concerned primarily with domestic issues, but that meant sometimes you had to go outside of the home and you had to vote for things like laws against the sale of liquor.
And did they also champion laws to beef up against abuse in the home? I mean, so at that point, women were so discouraged from reporting abuse unless, you know, they're terrible physical injuries, and many in those cases, there was absolutely no recourse for children or for wives to pursue action.
My immediate response, I have to think about this a little, but I don't think that violence against women was itself an issue. It really is sort of embedded in this WCTU campaign against alcohol.
That if men just stopped drinking, then their husbands wouldn't act crazy.
Right. Yes. When women get the vote, as they do early in our own state of California in 1911, they did undertake a whole series of laws. I guess this connects to your question. One of the campaigns that women argued was a good reason to have the vote, and they used their vote, was to raise the age of sexual consent, which in many states was like 9 or 12. And they want to raise the age of consent for all young people, but especially for girls up to the age of 18. So you could say that this is a campaign against what we call trafficking. In California, they also supported a law, worked for a law. It was against prostitution, but it wasn't going to penalize the prostitutes. It was against the real estate interests that harbored brothels and other especially men who profited off of prostitution.
We're talking with UCLA Professor of History Ellen Carroll Du Bois, suffrage, women's long battle for the vote, as she joins us in this extended hour, noon hour of Air Talk, a chance for us to dig deeper into some of these issues and special guests that we have. So we've got the Women's Christian Temperance Movement. We've got, for lack of a better term, the sort of, you know, the suffrage movement itself.
Right.
How much of this is are working in coordinated events, and how much are, you know, they're sort of regionally and organizationally doing their own thing?
Well, the WCTU is especially important in the late 19th century when its visionary leader, Frances Willard, dies in the 1890s. It becomes, as an organization, less important, although women who sort of learned the ropes in the WCTU move into other organizations. One of my favorite examples is a woman named Ella Reeve Bloor, who is a famous communist, one of the founders of the American Communist Party, and she started in the WCTU. I think they were Anthony and Willard were close. They were friends. And they coordinated as best they could. When there were campaigns, as there were through the 1890s into the 19-teens in places like Washington and Oregon and California, Willard was willing to pull back so that so that suffrage wouldn't be too... So in other words, the issue of prohibition, the issue of temperance, brings women into the movement, but it can drive men away. So how do you balance that? And when women's suffrage was up for a vote, the temperance forces pulled back.
We'll continue our conversation with Ellen Carroll Du Bois, suffrage, women's long battle for the vote, back in just a moment. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. It's the centennial year for women obtaining the right to vote in the U.S. We're talking with Distinguished Professor of History at UCLA, Ellen Carroll Du Bois. Her book is Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote. Right before we broke, you were talking about California women having the right to vote, and it wasn't the only Western state that in which women had that right. How were they able to vote? And it was even for national offices,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
How did they do that when there was no national amendment?
Well, the Constitution itself, you'll forgive me for a moment, has very little to say about voting, and it says nothing about who could vote. It does leave control over voting to the states. And after a brief period of trying to challenge that, the suffrage movement gave into that. So the 15th and the 19th and even the 26th Amendment about 18-year-old voting makes it clear that voting is under the control of the states. And those amendments just prohibit the states from particular named disfranchisements. So in those years when there was no chance for a national constitutional amendment, the suffrage movement moves back into the states and begins working, and here's your question, almost entirely west of the Mississippi, to get states to themselves amend their state constitutions. When they did, and the first state in which male voters agreed to do that was Colorado in 1893, women got full voting rights. They could vote not just for state offices, but for federal offices. So starting in 1896, Colorado women voted for president. The most important of these campaigns in the West was in California in 1911. This was the second effort in California. It had failed in 1896, but they came back. These women were very persistent. And in 1911, where there's a kind of progressive, and the word was then used, insurgency, they were able to get the California voters, male voters, to amend the Constitution. And by 1914, by 1916, there were 4 million women west of the Mississippi with these rights. Why the West?
Yeah.
Why the West? Well, the easy answer, which I don't think is really the right answer, is, you know, in the West, women were pioneers and men depended on them and they couldn't just be frilly petticoat wearers. That was probably part of it. But the real part of it, I think, was that the political parties in this newer part of the country were less well organized and less firmly entrenched. So in the 1890s and in the 1910s, third parties, really powerful third parties, arose. And unlike the established parties, they weren't afraid of the women's vote and they supported it. So in the 1890s, when a small group of states enfranchised women, and then in the 1910s, they were the beneficiaries of a more fluid partisan environment.
I was also wondering, and you know, maybe this wasn't a factor. My sense is that in the West, there were more women owning and operating businesses. There were, just because of the nature of Western settlement, that many women were in those positions, and much harder to do that in the East for women.
That's a really interesting question. I know in San Francisco, in the gold rush years, women entrepreneurs were very successful.
They're making a lot of money, many
yes,
of them.
Yes, they did. Some of them made it because there was a whole army of men without women to wash their clothes, and they had to pay other women to do so. Also, I don't know. We could be speculative about this. In the East, there are these powerful manufacturing interests that use women and children workers, especially garment and textile industries. And they're really opposed to women gaining the right to vote because they depend on ill-paid women's labor. There are in the Southwest, there's a women's garment industry as well. But it may be that the garment industry is less powerful in the East.
We're talking with UCLA historian Ellen Carroll Du Bois, Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote. And as we go through the ratification process, is it Tennessee the final state?
Yes. So let's back up for a minute.
Yeah.
We first have to get this amendment through Congress. Tens of thousands of amendments have been mentioned and brought to Congress and failed. So in 1918, that amendment finally, you know, where are we now? We're 60 years after, 70 years after Seneca Falls. It finally passes the House. Arguably, no, I'm not going to use that word again. The reason it passes the House is that the first important state east of the Mississippi, New York, the most powerful, richest state with the largest congressional delegation, amends its constitution in November of 1917. And at that point, the New York delegation becomes a pro-suffrage force. Really 3 months later, the House passes the amendment and it's on to the Senate. And suffragists had always had better support in the Senate. The Senate was seen as the loftier and more contemplative and less responsive to immediate prejudices. But in fact, it got stalled in the Senate for a year and a half. It was short 2 votes for a year and a half. And again, it's an electoral event. And this was the midterms of 1918, exactly 100 years before the great historical midterms of 1918, where the Republicans are going to take control. And at that point, the Democrats think, oh, my God, they're going to be able to make claims that suffrage was what they brought in, and they'll be able to claim the women's vote. And at that point, there's a battle between the two parties. In 18 months after the House passes it, the Senate finally passes it. And then we're off to the really hard part.
How long did ratification take?
It took 15 months, which is a long time. There were efforts to put a time limit on ratification, as did in the ERA. We were in the middle of the war and then of the Spanish flu. But suffragists poured into the states. They were lucky because of this long battle. There were state machinery there in every state. But finally, in like June of 1919, they're stalled at 35, and they need a 36th state. The only possibilities were in a few rock-ribbed conservative Republican northeastern states, Connecticut and I think it's New Hampshire, but I'm not sure, and the entire South, which was still smarting from the 15th Amendment and opposed to any other federal intervention in politics. And also, giving that black women gaining the right to vote would be much harder to undo than black men. At that point, efforts to get it in Connecticut failed, and it came down to a few upper southern states. I was talking about this in North Carolina, and it wasn't just Tennessee. North Carolina could have been the right state, but Tennessee was the final state. It was a southern state with a small Republican Party. There was party competition. And in August of 1919, it passes the Tennessee legislature.
So here we are 100 years later. Ellen, thank you so much. Great to have you with us. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
Ellen Carroll DuBois, UCLA professor of history. Her book, Suffrage: Women's Long Battle for the Vote. You're listening to AIR Talk on 89.3 KPECC.